Committee will come to order at about 8:09. With us this morning is Representative Dahl, Reverend Cogger, Reverend Grunberg, Reverend Johnson, and Representative and Vice Chair Bob Roses, and my trusted Chief of Staff back there, and Committee Aide Nancy Manley. So, good morning. On the agenda this morning, we have H.R. 39, which is about the Sea Treaty, H.B. 412, Legislative Council and LBNA Membership, and H.C.R. 23, Uniform Rules, Measure, Sponsors, and Reading. So, sounds like a very exciting bunch of stuff to listen to this morning. So, with that, let's go to H.R. 39. And that is a resolution urging the United States Senate to ratify the Law of the Sea Treaty. And I have... I guess I'm going to testify a question to Stephen Daugherty, the Attorney General, and Isaac Edwards of Senator Murkowski's office. And I'd ask Representative Grunberg if he could speak to this issue directly. Excuse me. I was part of the Joint Armed Services Committee in which this subject came up. Senator Murkowski did, in fact, back this treaty. I would like to have his help with it. And then when she spoke to the joint session of the House and the Senate, she did likewise. And so with that, Representative Grunberg, could you enlighten us on what this is all about and why we need it?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate your scheduling this so quickly. This follows what Senator Murkowski said, and it's based on what she and her staff drafted in the Compass piece, which I think is in your packet, and it basically sets out the advantages to this country in joining 155 roughly other countries and our allies and the world's maritime powers and the other Arctic Ocean bordering nations in establishing a regime and a legal framework for developing the seas and the resources in them, making certain that the rules of navigation are kept current, and resolving potential claims to land under the ocean floor. This is a good example of the problems that can result if there are insufficient protection of our country's interest are the fact that other bordering nations along the Arctic Ocean are seeking claims to the North Pole. And they've sent submarines and all kinds of things out there, as stated in the resolution. And we really haven't protected our interests as much as we could and should, and this treaty will go a long way towards doing it. The resolution has been now reported to the floor of the Senate by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, on which Senator Murkowski sits, for the second time. And this urges the Senate to take up ratification of that very important treaty. And I hope that they could do it this year. Otherwise, they have to go through the whole process again in the next Congress, and that would delay it even further. We have her staff, Mr. Isaac Edwards, on the line, and I believe we also have Stephen Daugherty from the Department of Law, and I would ask Mr. Edwards to be permitted to testify at this time to explain about the treaty realizing I understand you have a caucus at 9 o'clock, so we need to be finished with this and as much as we can get to the rest.
Thank you for announcing the caucus.
So we normally would have 2 hours, but we only have one.
Yes,
today.
That's right.
And so I'd ask the chair if he could ask Mr. Edwards to testify by telephone from Washington, D.C.
Yes, I will do that. I know that this, we had, I believe the Soviet planted a flag up there, and if I were president of the United States, and this is not an announcement that I'm running for president, but if I were the president of the United States, I'd send a submarine up there and remove the flag. But Mr. Edwards, are you online?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman. Can everybody hear me?
Hear you just great.
Great, thank you. And members of the committee, Representative Grunberg, thank you very much for the invitation to testify before you today. I know your time is short, so I will try to be brief. It might be a little bit difficult for those of us back in Washington, D.C. We tend to talk a bit, but I will do what I can. I should first note, as been said before, my employer, Senator Lisa Murkowski, is very much in favor of the treaty, very hopeful the U.S. Senate will ratify the treaty this year. As a result, it's probably likely that my remarks will reflect that position. Just to give you a little bit of background where the treaty is, on October 31st of 2007, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee voted by a vote of 17-4 to recommend Senate advice and consent to the treaty. It's the second time the committee has recommended advice and consent. The first time was back in 2004. The treaty is now pending on the full Senate's calendar, but no time has been set aside for its consideration. Because it is a treaty, it will need 67 votes to be ratified. I'll skip the history of the treaty and get more to the issues that have been raised and what opponents and proponents are saying. Opponents of the treaty generally cite a concern about a loss of sovereignty if the U.S. were to become a party to the treaty. They ask, why is it necessary for the U.S. to be a party? Say our Navy already has the freedom of movement around the oceans. Why would we put ourselves in a situation where that movement or our own individual actions might potentially be limited in what we can do? Proponents, including the U.S. Navy and Coast Guard, respond that it's necessary to lock in the rights of movement, the freedom of navigation, rather than depend on customary international law. Our Navy currently transits its ships through narrow straits around the world to maintain a customary use of those straits to show that they are international waters. But the law of the Sea Treaty would lock in those navigational rights. And while the situation may seem favorable now, that may not always be the case. I'd like to give you one example where international customary law has a tendency to change. You may recall about over a year ago, 15 British sailors were seized by Iranian forces and accused of being in Iranian waters, although evidence shows they were in Iraqi territorial waters. Well, following the Iraq-Iran War from 1988, there was a dispute over who owned what water. And since that point in time, it's been more of a custom or a practice of who owns what rather than a specific delineation. And so proponents of the treaty say that we shouldn't put ourselves in a very similar situation where customary law could change over time. We should lock in those rights now. And in addition, I would like also to point out that the Law of the Sea Treaty expands our own territorial waters where we have absolute sovereignty to 12 nautical miles. A previous treaty that we're a part to, from 1958, our territorial water only goes out to 3 nautical miles. In addition, the Law of the Sea Treaty provides for a new 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone. This was not in any of the treaties that we've previously been a party to. So although we're currently operating as if we have rights provided under the Law of the Sea Treaty to those zones and sovereignty, as a non-party to the treaty, other nations do not necessarily need to recognize our claims to those areas. And that's particularly important to Alaska. It's over half of the nation's coastline is in our state. And I'd like to point to a couple of international treaties that have great relevance to our fisheries that came about as a result of the Law of the Sea Treaty. The Convention on Straddling and Highly Migratory Stocks provides both access to and protections for fish stocks which migrate through the high seas and jurisdictions of other nations, and that includes our pollock fishery in the Bering Sea. The Convention on Fisheries in the Central Bering Sea is another treaty that gives us unprecedented degree of control over the activities of other fishing nations in the central portion of the Bering Sea beyond our and Russia's exclusive economic zone. Without the Law of the Sea Treaty, neither of those fishing agreements would have come into being. And in addition, I'd like to point out that our 1991 Maritime Boundary Treaty between Russia and the U.S., which is widely regarded as highly favorable to the U.S. in terms of fishing grounds and mineral rights, is consistent with the Law of the Sea Treaty. The U.S. Senate has ratified our Maritime Boundary Treaty. The Russian Duma has not. And there are increasing cries from Moscow to renegotiate that treaty because it's so favorable to the U.S. So if we don't ratify, if we don't become a party to the Law of the Sea Treaty, our maritime boundary treaty may also be in doubt, as Russia has not ratified it, and it would be extremely difficult to renegotiate a boundary agreement with similar positive results for the U.S. On the issue of sovereignty, the issue of subjecting the United States to an international dispute resolution tribunal is raised as an objection. You know, why should we be putting our interests, including our military activities, in somebody else's hands who's not sympathetic to the U.S. position? And it's a valid issue, and one that I can say has been and is addressed in the Senate resolution on advice and consent that would ratify the treaty. The Article 287 of the treaty allows for a declaration of which form of dispute resolution a party wishes to use. In a Senate resolution on advice and consent that says that the U.S. would choose a special arbitration tribunal for matters related to fisheries, marine environment, marine scientific research, and navigation, including pollution from vessels. And I can go into more details of what that tribunal would look like if members of the committee would like that. And in addition, and most importantly, Article 298 of the treaty says that a state may declare that it does not accept any of the procedures for dispute settlement for any of three types of disputes. And those include boundary delimitations for territorial waters, exclusive economic zones, or the continental shelf, disputes concerning military activities or law enforcement activities, including the definition of those activities, and disputes in which the U.N. Security Council is exercising its functions. And so the Senate resolution on advice and consent exempts the U.S. from all three of those categories, from boundaries, military activities, and U.N. Security Council activities. So we're not subject to international dispute resolution under the law of the Sea Treaty in those areas. And another issue raised is why should we become a party to the treaty now? Why can't it wait? And in my view, the answer is about the treaty's amendment process. Basically, when the treaty was laid out, it delayed the possibility of any amendment to it until 10 years after its entry into force. And that 10 years came about as of November 2004. So as of 2004, it's now open to amendment from parties to the treaty. We need to be a party to the treaty in order to block objectionable amendments. And even if an objectionable amendment would somehow come into force when the U.S. is a party, if the U.S. were to be a party to the treaty, the language doesn't necessarily impact us, because the only language that impacts us is what the Senate provides in the advice and consent to ratify the treaty, not language that occurs after the Senate has ratified the treaty, unless the Senate again provides an amendment to the treaty. So that's why it's important to be a party now, before any objectionable amendments might be adopted. In addition, as Representative Grunberg stated, we need to be able to defend our claims to the Arctic and our extended continental shelf. The Arctic Ocean covers about 3% of the Earth's surface, but it accounts for about 25% of the world's continental shelf. And the mapping expedition by the Coast Guard cutter Healy found that our continental shelf off of northern Alaska extends for an additional 100 miles beyond what we had previously thought. But we can't claim that area, the resources that are in it, without being a party to the treaty, or at least we can't have our claims recognized by the international community. So as the resolution notes, Russia's already made its claim that its extended continental shelf gives it control over half of the Arctic. And the commission on the limits of the continental shelf is examining that claim at the moment. Other nations are making their claims as well. In fact, 8 submissions have already been made for extended continental shelf claims since December of 2001. More are expected. And if you look at the makeup of the Commission on the Limits of the Continental Shelf, you have 21 members there who are experts in various fields of geology, geophysics, hydrography, but they also have to be nationals of parties to the law of the sea. So the U.S. cannot have a member on that commission because we're not party to the treaty at the moment. So we can't have a say in whether other nations' extended continental shelves are going to be internationally recognized or not. Can't refute those claims, and we can't put forward our own claims on that end. So those are the basic points that I'd like to get across. I know the time is limited. I'll stop here. If there are questions, concerns, happy to address those as need be.
Thank you very much for that good rendition. Representative Coghill.
Thank you very much. I understand from reading some of the material why this is necessary, but there are several questions with regard to sovereignty that maybe you could help me understand a little better. You mentioned several areas where this sovereignty might be affected, so I'll get to that. But kind of working back from where you started your testimony, You said that the Russians had claimed some of the subsurface on the Arctic. Is that now authorized under the treaty that they've signed on to?
In terms of authorized, that they can make that claim.
Yes. Is that,
they can make that claim in, through the Commission on the Continental Shelf, or the limitation of the Continental Shelf. You are allowed to claim an extended portion of the Continental Shelf if you can show that that subsurface area does actually come from your landmass, if you will. And so previously, countries were not able to make those claims because the technology was not there to show what their, you know, the mapping capabilities under the ocean and what the ocean floor would look like.
So, Mr. Chairman, they were not bound at all by this treaty in this particular case.
To make the claims?
Right.
They, in order to be internationally recognized, they had to submit those claims, and they have submitted those claims to the Commission on the Limitation of the Continental Shelf.
All right. Now, the one other question, Mr. Chairman. With regard to the maritime boundary, working back from your testimony, they have not ratified the maritime boundary.
That is correct.
Is that because of the change in their government from USSR to Russia?
No, I'm not going to rule that out. And the government has, the Russian government has basically said, we will follow this agreement. You know, we will act as if this treaty is in place. But there have been, and it's been increasing more and more of late. You're seeing various articles come out of Russia. You're seeing more and more people speak up about, you know, the U.S. got a really good deal in terms of the fishing grounds and what the potential mineral rights might be, and they don't like that deal. So they want to renegotiate the deal.
And I think I would argue with them. I think they're encroaching, ever encroaching. And so then the next question would be, how many dispute resolutions have happened within this treaty that have been resolved to the U.N. satisfaction?
To the U.N. or to the U.S.?
U.N., because U.S. would not be involved in it.
Right. I don't have that number in front of me. I don't know it. I will say that the U.N. plays a very, very extremely limited role in any of this. In fact, it's more of a in name only, if you will.
Well, that was going to be part of my problem. A treaty is one thing, but to have some control by the UN troubles me. So, I'm glad to hear that.
Well, yeah, no, and I can say that basically the only connection the UN has to this treaty is its title. It was negotiated under the auspices of the UN, but it has no role in the governance of the treaty itself or the commissions that are set up by the treaty.
And then the question would be one of the reasons that it has not gotten from the Senate to the other body or to the President. Can you give me what are the primary reasons?
It does not need House, because it's a treaty, it does not need the House of Representatives to vote on it.
Thank you.
So it would just be a Senate vote. The administration has already signed on to the convention itself, so it has support. So the remaining step, the last step in the process, is Senate ratification of the treaty.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chairman, thank you for letting me ask these questions. This can help me
come to the level. I think it's very important for all of it. While I have it, I would like to recognize Reverend Johann, who joined us some time ago.
The reason I ask for the dispute resolution history is because the recognition from my understanding of Russia's absolute disregard for treaties and why we would subject ourselves to something, play by rules that others will not play by. And I'm feeling that this might just do that. We might end up being 155 plus one if we sit on the council, or we might be just one to one if we stay outside of the treaty. So that's kind of the thinking that I end up landing on.
And that's a fair point. I would point out that the to two conventions that I mentioned, the convention on the straddling and highly migratory stocks and the convention on fisheries in the Central Bering Sea, both have dispute resolutions by arbitration clauses, which is what the U.S. would adhere to in the Law of the Sea Treaty. It's set up exact same way, and you know, Russia is involved in those as well.
Okay, and that's one of the reasons why it's going to be very important for me before I can allow this to move that we understand who's in charge of the dispute resolution and how it's been handled, because what we're going to do is subject ourselves as a nation to a panel that may not be of any of our choosing and may not be sympathetic at all to the United States.
I'm happy to go over how the members of the arbitration panel are selected, if that would
that would
be helpful
to me.
Yes, please.
Okay. Article, I'll just kind of go back to the beginning for just a minute. Article 287 says a state can choose from a number of mechanisms for dispute resolutions. You have the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, there's the International Court of Justice, and then there's the Arbitration Tribunal. There's two different types of arbitration tribunals, and a plain arbitration tribunal and a special arbitration tribunal. The Senate's resolution advising consent says the U.S. will choose the arbitration. The under the special arbitration process, which is the principally chosen one for the maritime issues, both parties select two arbitrators, and then those four arbitrators select a fifth and a final arbitrator. If they're unable to agree on that fifth arbitrator, they can agree on a third party to select a fifth arbitrator, and if still no agreement can be reached, the Secretary General of the UN would then appoint the fifth arbitrator. Under regular arbitration, each party selects one arbitrator and then mutually agree on three other arbitrators. And if there's no agreement, a third party may appoint the three remaining arbitrators.
And, Mr. Chairman, the third party would be the UN Secretary?
It doesn't necessarily have to be that. It could be whatever third party the two countries agree to.
So it'd be a mutual agreement?
Correct.
Okay. All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Beverly Dahl?
Yeah. Yes, I just have a question. This is Representative Dahl. Have there been times in the past where we wished that we had been part of this treaty incidents that would have been to our favor?
I think that right now, from Senator Murkowski's point of view anyway, she wishes we could be a part of the treaty because of Russia's claims in the Arctic. Russia has submitted its claim to the Commission on the Limitation of the Continental Shelf, its claim that it would basically have over control over half of the Arctic Ocean. And we're not in a position where we can refute that claim and show our own research to show what the U.S. claim would be and why Russia's claim is not necessarily so.
But that wasn't my question. I see that this first approved the convention in 1982, and then it's been up since 1994. Is that correct? For
the convention that was approved in 1982, or it was open to signature in 1982.
Okay.
So basically, the text was more or less agreed to by the negotiators, and then it was opened up to countries around the world to become a party to if they so wished. The United States declined to become a party to that because of a provision on deep seabed mining. It was deemed to be very much of a, for lack of a better word, socialistic in nature in terms of transfer of technology. No developed nation really wanted to be involved because they would not get any of the benefits type system. And so there was a negotiation or renegotiation of that portion of it, which led to a 1994 agreement on deep seabed mining. So enough parties, enough states had ratified and become a member to the Law of the Sea Treaty by 1994 with the agreement of this deep seabed mining provision that it went into effect, it went into force. And then so that's where the 10-year clock started ticking in terms of when amendments could take place.
Representative Dahl, continue.
Yes, thank you. So my question remains, we have never been party to this, and have there been times in the past where we feel that this has caused a limitation on us, that there's been a problem? I know that today there's obviously a great need, but I'm just asking about in the past how...
In the past, not so much, in part because we had that 10-year window of time when no amendments to the treaty could be offered. So there's no chance that the treaty could change. So there was a little bit of wiggle room in that sense, in that the terms would not change on us. Also, we have been essentially, since 1992, under President Reagan's executive order at that time, operating as if in compliance with the treaty. So there have not been times when we have been challenged on it. But the concern is that at least what the U.S. Navy has brought forward and other members of the military, is that we don't want to rely just on that. We would like to lock in those rights.
I see. Thank you.
Yeah, and Mr. Edwards, thank you very much. For the benefit of our clerks over here, could you give your exact job title, please?
Sure. Name is Isaac Edwards. I am Legislative Director for Senator Lisa Murkowski.
And also, will you give us your email by email or something?
Oh, absolutely. I will definitely send that.
Thank you. That's sufficient. Okay. Representative Gruenberg, I think you had a question.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I understand it, all of the administrations, both parties, have supported this treaty since it was initially proposed. Am I correct?
That is correct, with the one caveat that the Reagan administration would not sign off on it in 1982 until the deep seabed mining provision had been fixed.
And that was as of, when was that fixed again?
1994.
Okay. Second question. It has gone several times to the floor of the Senate. I understand under the rules of the Senate, any single senator can block consideration. Is that what's happened here?
Because a treaty needs 67 votes, and it would be our own procedural manners that we have, you could bring it up even if one member would object to it. I think that there is, of late, and this is my own speculation, but in terms of political jockeying, making sure that there are 67 votes there before they bring the resolution up.
And finally, Mr. Chair, would a resolution from the Alaska State Legislature help, and if so, how and why?
It would be very helpful in terms of, number one, showing that there is support outside of Washington, D.C. for us. It would be helpful in showing that the one state in the United States that makes the U.S. an Arctic nation recognizes the importance of the law of the sea and how it could impact our own Arctic and Russia's claims and other nations' claims and the growing importance of that area of the world. So in terms of showing the rest of the United States Senate that this is an important issue to Alaska, it should be an important issue to the nation, that would be very helpful.
If I may.
One more, Mr. Governor Gruenberg.
My recollection from the time I served on the staff in the U.S. Senate, when these reports come out, often there are minority views. I've looked through the report that you folks sent me, which was the report dated, well, the only one I have is March 11, 2004. Maybe there's a later report that I don't have, but at least on that one, I don't see any minority views. And I thought that was kind of unusual. What's going on?
In 2004, the resolution on advice and consent was reported out by a vote of 19-0. So there was no minority view on that time. The resolution in 2007 was voted out on a vote of 17-4. So there is some objections. I don't believe the committee has yet put out the actual report on the treaty itself.
Do you expect that to occur within the next 3 weeks?
I can definitely find out, and if there is some information, I will definitely get it to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for Mr. Edwards from the committee? Representative Coghill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm somewhat ignorant of the treaty itself, but help me understand, is there any other Arctic nation outside of the northern coast of the United States that is not part of this treaty?
No. All the Arctic nations are party to the treaty.
Right.
And including, and as well, I would say all 155 nations are party to the treaty.
Thank you very much, sir.
And Representative Kaga, I will get you what information I can on the history of dispute resolution and what the decisions have come down as.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate testifying this morning. Are the cherry trees in blossom back there?
Yes, they are.
Nothing like that here yet. Could you stand by? Do you have to while we discuss this a little more?
Absolutely.
Some questions? Thank you, sir. Mr. Daugherty, Attorney General's office, do you have any comments you'd like to make on this? Give us any guidance? Are you here?
Mr. Chair, I'm just available for questions. The Department of Law doesn't take a position on policy issues, so I'm here available for questions.
Any questions, Mr. Daugherty? Okay. With that, anybody else in the audience would like to testify on this or online? If not, I'll close public testimony. And are there any amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chair. You should have an amendment by me.
That's amazing. Yeah, amendment by Representative Grunberg.
Well, wonders never cease. And I ask that be labeled number one.
Okay.
I'll object so I can hear it.
Yeah. This, as usual, when we drafted this, I looked at it and saw that it could have been improved really grammatically and stylistically. I don't believe, and Denise, correct me, I don't think that there are any substantive changes. No. And I did it all at once. I didn't do, I'm sorry?
Number six wasn't in the original bill.
No, it mentioned. Thanks for bringing that up, Nancy. I did it as an omnibus amendment rather than a CS so that you could see. Let me go through each one. The first one, deleting for ratification, if you look at the bill itself, you would see on line 6 ratification appears, and then on line 7 it appears again. That's really a typo, and that cures that. The second one is on page 2, line 18, and this was suggested by the drafter, and Don Bullock was correct, that the claims, it should be claim of authority by, that's the correct term. And then on lines 23 to 26, that whole whereas paragraph was just kind of elephantine, and I had drafted it, so I accept the responsibility for that. So what I asked Don to do was just to break it out so it read a little easier. And what Ms. Manley had said was environmental concerns number 6 on line 20 of the amendment. That is actually in there in the last phrase on line 26 of the bill itself. We broke out the economic development into sub 5 and environmental concerns into line 6. So there's really nothing there, and I would ask a unanimous consent for the adoption of the amendment.
Just let me object so they can go over line 26 again on page 2.
Sure.
I don't have the actual amendment.
Oh, you don't?
It was in their bill
packet.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's at the beginning. Sorry. I'll take that out here. I think I would rather have left in there the economic development and environmental concerns.
It is. It just breaks it out.
Okay, I see it. Breaks it out. Okay.
That's so it's easier to read.
Yeah. All right. Got it.
And I think I'd like to say on the record, Mr. Bullock is a good drafter, and I think he did a good job here.
All right. I'll remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, with that, amendment number 1 passes, and this is the first time in this committee the word elephantine has been used. I think it's a very good word. I can't wait to use it in some future occasion.
Maybe at a convention.
And I will be going to a convention later, so maybe I can use it there. Any other discussion on this resolution? Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question. Either of the two people online. I'm looking specifically at Article 26, which charges may be levied upon a foreign ship. And I don't know if the Attorney General's office has a copy of that, of the actual treaty in front of them. But it says charges may not be levied upon a foreign ship for reasons just as they're passing through. And then it says charges may be levied upon a foreign ship passing through the territorial waters as payment only for specific service rendered to the ship, and these charges shall be levied without discrimination. And I'm curious what effect that would have on our taxation of cruise ships, and if we would be in violation of the treaty if we didn't treat every ship the same.
Just as
specifically big ships and the smaller ships that don't pay the tax.
Just a question.
Reverend Grunberg, and then we may want to go to Attorney General's office.
I think that just for the record and for ourselves, the representative is referring to the Red Book, and it's on page 33 is that article, so that the record's clear. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is that correct, Mr. Daugherty?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that this would have any impact on cruise ships that are making landings in Alaska. The right of innocent passage is passage through a territorial sea without making a landing within the state, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions, Mr. Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, I think the question would be the discrimination between ships based upon size, like number 2 of Article 26 on page 33 of the Red Book.
Is that correct?
That is kind of the genesis of my question.
Any comment on that from anybody?
Maybe one of the two witnesses.
Yes,
I'm hoping someone can.
Yeah, Ms. Daugherty and Mr. Edwards, can you comment on that?
I'm just looking at Article 26, Part 2 right now.
Could they by themselves?
And I would have to get back to you. I'd have to check with the State Department. What their reading of that is.
Mr. Chairman, just for the record, I did not support the cruise tax, so I'm hoping that it might, in fact, be something that the cruise line could hang their hat on. So I would certainly, I just wanted to call everyone's attention to that.
Representative Grunberg.
Who was that who answered? You guys have to identify yourself since we've got both of you on the line, and I don't know you well enough.
I apologize. It's Isaac Edwards with Senator Murkowski in Washington.
If Mr. Chair, could we ask that he respond not just to Representative Johnson, but to the committee so that we...
Yeah, that'd be good because hopefully we can move this resolution out, but we still need to get that information before it go to the next committee or House floor of wherever it's going.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunberg.
It just goes to this committee and then directly to the Rules Committee. And so, those clutches, we hope it will escape and go onto the floor.
Mr.
We don't need 67 votes around here.
Representative... Representative Dahl.
Thank you. Yes, this is to Mr. Edwards. It says in the very bottom of our resolution that the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea will not interfere with intelligence gathering efforts of the United States or the navigational freedom of the United States Navy. Now, that ability, that sovereignty, is that under Article 298? Is that what you were referring to before?
That is correct.
Okay.
Mr. Edwards, correct?
Yes, sir.
And so we could cross over into other areas in that intelligence gathering freely?
It is up to the United States, and this is a permissible definition under the law of the sea. We, under our resolution of advice and consent, we determine what a military activity is. We determine what an intelligence gathering activity is in terms of our own activities. So in along those lines, we have exempted ourselves. If under the Senate's resolution of advice and consent, we would have exempted ourselves from anybody questioning our ability to do that under the law of the sea.
And there we go.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so that would also pertain to Canada, Russia, and others who would also be gathering intelligence?
Well, if they have exempted themselves from that article of the law of the sea, they would define in their own terms what they believe their military activity is.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, I entertain a motion to move this resolution. Representative Voges.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House Joint Resolution number 39 as amended with individual recommendations, and there isn't one, but if there were, any attached fiscal note.
As amended, did you say that?
I did say as amended.
Is there any objection?
I'm going to object just to make a statement.
Yes, sir.
I'm not comfortable yet with the law of the sea treaty, and I understand that Alaska has the majority coastline in the United States, so I'm open to the discussion, and I will have to check out the dispute resolution claims and settlements that have come. It's been my experience, especially with our biggest coastal friend, the Russians, that they have disregarded treaties, have claimed lands, and have taken land from the United States. And so I'm confident that our friends from the other side, Canada, Greenland, Denmark, Iceland, Norway, will be easier to deal with. And so, but I think what we might end up doing inadvertently is putting ourselves in that position where we're one of 155 rather than one to one with the treaty. And since we have had agreements such as NATO and everything, there have been a lot of funding come from the United States, but we've been backed into corners by refusal to agree to participate in some areas of those particular agreements. And so once you make those types of agreements, it seems like America has always been willing to submit itself and others are not. And so when we get into these areas, I always get a little shaky. So with that, I just wanted to put it on the record. And I wanted those from Murkowski's office to hear it, because I need some comfort level before I'm willing to agree to this. So,
and I hope that Mr. Edwards and others perhaps would provide some comfort or at least information on it. I think you raised a very valid point. The United States is a sovereign nation. We are a sovereign state within a sovereign nation, and we must maintain our sovereignty. And that's what this is all about, really. Representative Greenberg, and I want to...
Mr. Edwards, through the chair, or Mr. Daugherty, do either of you wish to put anything on the record in response to what Representative Coghill has just said?
This is Mr. Edwards in Sam Murkowski's office. I understand that there's a concern about other nations not living up to their end of their commitments. We have many, many treaties that we are party to, both multilateral and bilateral. As I said before, I will get you information about the dispute resolution history and whether or not there have been issues out there with Russia in particular. But I guess it's one of those, from my own point of view, that we're a party to many treaties, and that's always any issue that we're going to be facing is, are other countries going to play by the rules? I don't have a good answer to say to that, other than that's part of what people look up to the United States for, is that we do play by the rules.
Okay. And now, if this passes out of committee, this will be going next to the Rules Committee for possible scheduling on the House floor. Representative Coghill of this committee happens to be the chair of that committee. So if you could get into direct contact with his office,
of course,
it'd be helpful, I think, to all of us.
Of course.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll remove my objection.
Okay. Any other objection? If not, we move
Mr. Chair,
H.J.R. 39 from this committee. We only have a few moments before we have to leave. I would like to bring to the table H.J.R. 23, just a very, very brief introduction, H.J.R. 23.
Mr. Chair, could I make a request?
Yes, and I can make an answer.
Okay. We have the other two bills, and they're basically both introduced by me.
Yes.
Could we do first 412? Just quickly, I'll introduce it very fast.
You'd rather do...
Yeah, because it's quicker, and it's one concept.
All right.
And I would expect I'll take about 2 minutes, and we can adjourn.
Okay. So we'll bring HB 412 to the State Affairs table.
Mr. Chair, this bill is being introduced on behalf of every member of the House minority, all 16 of us. We've all co-sponsored it. It's the second time the bill has been introduced. This is in the 25th legislature. It was introduced by Senator by Representative Berkowitz and all members of the House minority in the 23rd legislature. We just didn't do it in the 24th. It just slipped by. And what this does, it completes, with one exception, the concept that was begun back in 1987-88 in the 15th legislature, when Fritz Pettyjohn, the House minority leader, came to me as the House majority leader and asked for proportional representation on the standing committees. And at the time, we were not in a coalition, and the members of the Democratic majority agreed to the concept of proportional representation on the standing committees, and we amended the uniform rules accordingly. But for some reason, we didn't, and I don't remember why, whether it was political or whether it was just escaped. We didn't do these two committees, Ledge Council and LB&A, at the same time. I don't know whether it was because we thought everything was contained in the rules. These two committees are contained in statute. They're statutory creations, and they don't require a two-thirds vote. It's a strict majority vote. The only committee that we haven't included in House Bill 412 was the Joint Armed Services Committee, because we just didn't feel that that was necessary. It's a kind of a different kind of a committee. And all this does is change the current membership on Ledge Council and LB&A to proportional representation. And there are basically four sections to the bill. There are six sections, but they parallel, and they just do the same thing, providing proportional representation on each of the two committees. And I had asked the minority leader and the minority whip to be here, but neither one was able to be here this morning. They support the legislation, and if you have the time to, you know, have a full hearing on this, I'm sure that they will be here, or one of them will be here.
One question, if I may. What is the majority-minority membership now, and if we were to adopt, what would it be then?
It would be, right now, there's only one member from each of the on each of the committees from the minority, and there are 14 members on the Ledge Council, and that means seven senators, and they only have five members in the minority, so I believe they would still only get one in the Senate, and of course, we have 16, and I think that would give us two in the House. Just like on this committee, there are two members of the minority. And with respect to LB&A, if you take a look at page 2, line 22, there are 10 members, and a quarter of them, or two, would be the set number of senators, and there would be, I think, three or four House members. I'd have to figure the math on that.
Yeah, if you can have that information for the next
absolutely
time to bring it to the table. With that, I had one. I'm going to hold HB 412 for another hearing at another date. And do we have time to even bring the other one up to introduce it?
I would prefer not. It's a number of different procedural changes involving the introduction of measures, and I would like to, when you do schedule this, Mr. Chair, and I hope we have the time, I would like to invite Tam Cook, who worked with me on this, not just to be on the phone, but to, if she can have a minute, to come on down, because she's really the expert. And we have a letter from Susie Lowell, the clerk of the House. I don't think I did that. The clerk of the House, that I think that she does not want the provisions in there about the reading of the titles of the bill. I'm going to check with her. I may move to delete those. We're trying to streamline some of this.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for your participation today. The House State Affairs Committee will adjourn at about 8:59. Have a good day.